Good afternoon, everyone, and happy Sabbath to you all. I know there's a lot going around right now with pollen and all that stuff that makes everybody feel yucky when they first get up in the morning, and I hope that you're not dealing with that too much, and I'm glad to see you're here, although we are missing a few who are dealing with some sort of an illness. Just a couple of announcements. Here, I just received an email from Mr. Dunkel that there will be a meal at the feast in Cincinnati, a catered meal. I guess they've done this before. I will send out information for that. Payment's not due until like October 7th or something like that. So I'll get that out and I'll post it here next week. But if you are going to be going to Cincinnati for the feast and you want to have the catered meal on Monday, October 14th, you can be planning for that. Also, I do want to say that there is a Good Works program set up right now to help those who have been affected by the hurricane in the Bahamas. You know, it was one of those things when that hurricane was coming, and it was kept getting bigger and bigger, and it was headed for Florida, and I was praying, as I'm sure many of you were, that it wouldn't hit our coast and wouldn't destroy our beautiful state of Florida, and it just sat there and churned right over top of Bahamas forever, and I thought, well, I didn't even think about those poor people, but they were hit very hard, and so we do have a relief effort set up at Good Works if you would want to participate in that. As we enter into this month of focused studies, we're going to be looking at prophecy. I felt like this would be a good month to enter into something like that since we're headed for the fall holy days. It seems like a very timely time to look at prophecy as we're looking forward to end time events with, as pictured by the fall holy days. So as we see things around us starting to take shape, we should be, as was mentioned in the sermonette today, paying attention to it and focusing on what is happening around us. Of course, the topics that are covered are going to be far too large to be covered in a sermon or a sermonette, as was mentioned by Mr. Nick. This could be three sermons easily, and probably even more than that to cover the subject of the beast, the false prophet, and the Antichrist. But it will be something to kind of maybe jar your memory of things you've heard over the years, especially if you've been in the church for any length of time. And it can be something to get you maybe started on your own studies as far as prophecy goes. I will say that the United Church of God has an excellent website. If you are looking for anything, not just prophecy, but they do have a lot of material on prophecy there that can help you out as far as studying and continuing to look at prophetic events that will be taking place. Prophecy is one thing that is a proof of the Bible. When you see something written thousands of years ago that has come to take place, very few people can argue with it and say that, you know, the Bible is not accurate. The prophet Daniel foretold these characters that we're going to be talking about today 2,500 years ago, as well as other nations that would rise up after the kingdom that he was living in. So we're going to turn back and we're going to look at that in a little bit. What we're looking at is an end time dictator and military leader and a false religious leader. And to better understand that, we need to take a look at how Christianity became a state-sponsored religion, because that is very integral to the events that will take place in the end time. And is all of that prophecy, the first thing Jesus warned about was counterfeit Christianity. Matthew 24, verses 4 and 5. Matthew 24, verse 4 and 5. Warning his followers, Jesus answered and said to them, "Take heed that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many." So we're seeing someone who's actually coming and saying that they should be worshipped in place of Christ, and that what they have to say supersedes whatever it is that was said before them, either by Christ or by the Old Testament or anywhere in the Bible. So, almost from the very start, Christ was warning his followers about these who would come to deceive. Deceivers began trying to influence and infiltrate the New Testament church almost immediately. And that is why this warning went out from Christ. Before long, there were several branches of Christianity. There was one that tried to stay faithful and pure to the Bible and the teachings of Christ. And then there were others who kind of like sprung up at this time and was trying to gain followers as well. These ones that sprang up started blending together biblical teachings with pagan rituals and pagan people and those who are worshipped in that religion. This blending is called syncretism. And many of the popular pagan Roman beliefs that were added to Christianity actually originated with the ancient Babylonian mystery religion. These were not new things. Christ came speaking of the Father. People started blending together customs and events that had already been worshipped for many years, and were blending it with Christianity. One of the ways that Satan deceives people is to mix a little bit of truth in with the falsehoods. So that way you can kind of like, you can catch people off guard. If you have some truth in there, then they can say, oh, well, yeah, this, you know, this is Jesus. We're celebrating Jesus. But they take something that was already pagan, had been around for thousands of years, and they associate that with Jesus, and most people don't even take the time to research and realize that what they are actually worshiping is a mixture of truth and falsehood. So customs and traditions of false religions were mixed in with biblical principles. Roman Emperor Constantine decided to make Christianity the official state religion to further unify and strengthen his empire. Now, again, his motives were to further strengthen and unify his empire. He was not necessarily a religious person. In fact, he was very pagan in most of his life. And on his deathbed, when he thought he was probably at a point where he needed to have the most of his sins forgiven and he would probably be okay from there on, he was then baptized on his deathbed as a Christian. So although he's looked at as a Christian ruler, it's because he made things more favorable for the form of Christianity that was around at his time. So he decided to make Christianity the official state religion. He used his power to bring in different factions of Christianity and to bring all these together. And the result was an official recognition of various beliefs that were similar in many ways to the popular pagan Roman sun worship. And these were brought into the religion at that time called Christianity and became state-sponsored. By this time, for example, the visible majority of church had adopted pagan Sunday observance in place of biblical Sabbath keeping. This was already something that was done by these groups that were calling themselves Christians. In 321, Constantine legislated that Sunday should be a day of rest for all the citizens. So he made this a state-sponsored day of rest. Again, his purpose here was to unify and bring together his people. And we'll see this is going to happen again in the end time, because when you can unify people behind religious beliefs, then you can extend your power over them. So this state-sponsored church grew, further evolved and grew in power and became known as the Roman Catholic Church. At times, the Bishop of Rome, or the Pope, as he is well known, had such great power and influence that he would install and remove emperors throughout the European nations. Because of the intimate relationship between the church and state for several centuries, the empire was called the Holy Roman Empire. And that's because these two were so integral to each other's plans that they would call them the Holy Roman Empire. This combined church-state began to persecute other Christians and became especially intense during this time, especially those who were sticking to the truth that was taught, such as Sabbath observance. The Roman Catholic Church adopted a governmental structure that's very similar to the governmental structure of the old Roman Empire And many times historians have remarked upon the Roman Catholic Church as being a mirror image of the Roman Empire. So that's a little bit of the history of how religion became state-sponsored and the purpose behind it. Again, it wasn't because Constantine was a religious man necessarily and was trying to, you know, help his people out in any way. It was simply for his own gains and his own power. Let's turn over to Daniel 2, and we're going to look at four world-ruling empires illustrated by Daniel. So much power. Could you even imagine being the one flying that right now? That would be so awesome. Not that being here is not fun, but wow, that would be wild. Okay, now he's just showing off. Okay, let's turn over to Daniel 2, and we'll look at these four world-ruling empires. King Nebuchadnezzar had a dream in Daniel 2, and he was really trying out his... Come on. He was really trying out his magicians and his fortune tellers and all this, and he wouldn't tell them what the dream was. He said, you need to come and tell me what my dream is. This troubled him so much. He said, you come and tell me what my dream is and then interpret it. And of course, no one could come and tell him what his dream was, and he became very angry and started having the wise men and all these people put to death because they could not do what it was he was asking them to do. But Daniel was able to come before him and, of course, giving all credit to God, let him know that he was going to let him know what the dream was and the interpretation of it. This is one of those things that was history given in advance of time. And now as we look back, we can see what it is that Daniel was talking about and the empires that he was talking about in this dream. This dream image represented the entire future from Nebuchadnezzar's Babylonian Empire until the later days. So at this time when Daniel gave the interpretation of this dream, which was about 2,500 years ago, it told history all the way up still beyond our time now. So let's turn over to Daniel 2, starting in verse 31. And we'll read Daniel here coming before the king. Daniel says, "You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands and struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces." Verse 35, "Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." So this great image that he saw and all these wonderful materials that it was made of, when it was knocked down, became nothing more than dust and the wind blew it away. Verse 36, Daniel says, "This is the dream, and now we will tell you the interpretation of it before the king." Verse 37, "You, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of man dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. But after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours, then another kingdom, a third kingdom of bronze which shall rule over all the earth, and a fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. Whereas you saw the feet and toes partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, yet the strength of the iron shall be in it. Just as you saw the iron mixed with the ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with the ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. Can you put up that first image? I have here, I'm sure many of you have seen this, especially if you've been in the church for any length of time, this image of the statue that King Nebuchadnezzar dreamed about. This particular one was taken from our booklet, The Last Superpower, I believe it's called, which is a new one that came out not too long ago. But they have the image of Nebuchadnezzar, of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Again, as I said, many of you are, I'm sure, very familiar with this image, the head of gold, the chest of silver, and then we go down to bronze, and then the legs, which is the clay and the steel. This head of gold represented Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, Babylon. From history, we can determine the next three empires. They were the Medo-Persians, the Greek, and the Roman empires. As mentioned by Daniel, each succeeding kingdom is inferior to the one before it. And as we go down, the value of the metal gets less and less. But it also gets stronger as you go down. Gold is very valuable, but it's a very malleable steel. It's very soft. So as mentioned by Daniel, each succeeding kingdom is inferior to the one before it, but the strength increases. And the sad part is Nebuchadnezzar, really, when you read about him, he wasn't that great of a leader. I mean, you know, morally and to be this fine head of gold, basically what we're seeing is from there on, things just keep getting worse. And the bar wasn't all that high to start with. Also in Daniel 7, these empires are represented by beasts, different animals that are called out. And we'll look at that in a little bit. So what is the Bible talking about when it talks about beasts? In prophecy, the word beast, which is a wild, dangerous animal, not something domesticated, not something you can control, but something that is completely out of control and wild, can refer to a Gentile kingdom, which would be a non-Israelite, a false church, or a dictatorial leader of a kingdom or church. And here are some examples of prophetic beast. Successive Gentile empires are pictured in Daniel 7 as four great beasts. If you want to turn over to Daniel 7, we'll look at verses 3 through 7. And these four beasts that we're going to be looking at correspond to these four different parts of the statue over here. Daniel 7, verse 3, and four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off and was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And suddenly another beast, a second, like a bear, it was raised up on one side and had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And they said thus to it, arise and devour much flesh. Now, it's interesting that this bear would have 3 ribs in its mouth because the second kingdom that rose up won 3 major battles against its enemies. And, of course, this was being foretold many years before that ever took place. Going on, verse 6, after this I looked, and there was another like a leopard, which had on its back 4 wings of a bird. The beast also had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a 4th beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Again, these 4 beasts correspond to the 4 parts of the image in Daniel 2, representing the Babylonian, the Persian, Greek, and Roman empires. Another example of a beast is in Revelation 13, verse 1 and 4. You don't have to turn over there. But the beast that is there is the Roman Empire, especially the last revival of the Roman Empire before Christ returns. Revelation 13. Actually, let's do look at this when we'll turn over there. Revelation 13 continues on, and then it transitions from speaking of this revived Roman Empire as a beast to speaking of its leader, its political and military dictator, as being the beast. So Revelation 13, we'll look down verses 1 through 8. Again, you'll see a lot of similarities between this beast and the fourth one that was described in Daniel 7. Revelation 13, verse 1, "Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and on its horns ten crowns, and on its heads a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, his mouth like the mouth of a lion. The dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and this deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast. So they worshipped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, 'Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him?' And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. It was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given to him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. All who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world." So we see this transition from the nations being represented as a beast to the person who is leading him being represented as this beast. And this is, as we can tell from this reading, a worldwide dominance. Revelation 13, verse 11, there's another beast who had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. A lamb is a biblical symbol of Jesus Christ, and a dragon is a biblical symbol for Satan the devil. Therefore, he's a powerful religious authority. He's claiming to represent Christ, but in reality, he is a tool of Satan. He deceives those who dwell on the earth by the signs and miracles that he is able to do. He uses them to gain worldwide allegiance. Many followers around the world will follow this person because of the great signs and the miracles that he'll be able to perform. And lastly, Satan himself can be referred to as a beast. You know, he's referred to as a dragon and a serpent. And of course, he is the underlying person behind all these beast powers. The Roman Empire throughout history will fail and then experience 10 revivals, 7 of which are ridden by the great harlot. Most of these have happened up to this point. In fact, 9 of them have. Daniel 7, verse 7, if you're still in Daniel 7, we'll be reading verse 7. It says, "After I saw this in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with his feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns." These 10 horns are representative of a few things. One of them is the 10 revivals of the Roman Empire. Revelation 13, we'll be reading verse 1 and verse 3. Revelation 13, verse 1 says, "Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on its horns 10 crowns, and on its heads a blasphemous name." Verse 3, "And I saw one of the heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled and followed the beast." This deadly wound refers to the fall of the Roman Empire in A.D. 476. But the empire has been healed through many successive revivals. Luke, can you put up the second image? There's a chart here of the partial chart of the prophecies of world empires. This, again, is from the UCG website. By the time Christ returns, this empire will have experienced 10 revivals. These are represented by the 10 horns on the fourth beast of Daniel 7 and the 10 horns of the beast in Revelation 13. The little horn of Daniel 7, verse 8 and verse 20 is a powerful church whose leader speaks pompous words, makes authoritative pronouncements that are claimed to be infallible. So again, his word is above anything that was in the Bible or even the words of Christ. Three horns fell before this little horn, meaning the church did not enter into a relationship with the first three revivals of this empire. And that is brought out here near the end of this bottom of this chart. Let's see if my little pointer here works. Kind of comes and goes. This area right here talks about the three revivals without the church being a part of them. I can't read what they are, but you can read what they are. So there were three revivals without the woman riding on the beast. It was simply just brought back as an empire, but not necessarily a religious empire. The last seven revivals of the Roman Empire, the seven that are ridden by the great harlot, I'll go through those here in a second. In prophecy, a woman can be symbolic of a church, a religion, or a church. In this chapter, a powerful church and her leader attempts to steer the beast from which she gets support. And again, there have been six revivals since those first three where the church was an integral part of the revival. They were the Justinian Empire, the Charlemagne Empire, the Empire of Otto I, Charles V, Napoleon, and then the last one was the Germany and Italy alliance, where they were trying to raise Europe back up into a unified world power. And we are already seeing signs of another revival of this empire. They are working very hard right now and have been for quite some time. Actually, this goes all the way back to post-World War II. Europe has wanted to be united, and they have been working to this end for many times. There is an effort underway right now to unify the continent. Something I find very interesting is the prophetic symbolism is something that Europe seems to be embracing. I'm going to show you a few pictures here. But this prophetic symbolism is something that they seem to be embracing as they're trying to build itself into a union of nations. Can you put up the third picture? Nope, next. Fourth. That one. This was a poster put out in 1992 by the European Parliament. I'm sure you'll notice some odd things about this. There's a lot of symbolism in this poster. One of the first things that catches your eye is the upside down star. Usually, excuse me, when a star is on representing a nation, if it's right side up, that's usually a just nation. Like we have all the stars on our flag and they're turned right side up. When they're upside down like this, that's actually a pagan symbol, and it represents a goat. And you can look up here, it's the two horns, its two ears, and its chin. Usually when this is used as a symbol for authority, it's not good for the people. Of course, does the tower look familiar to you back there? So they are projecting themselves to be building this Tower of Babel. And in fact, over there, it even says, what's that say? Europe, many tongues, one voice. Thank you. They can't say this does not represent the Tower of Babel. I mean, that's a direct saying that they are, you know, out of many tongues, one voice. They are definitely giving themselves a throwback to the Tower of Babel, the beginning of the Babylonian mystery religion. And it's kind of really, I don't know, I would say a spit in the eye of God, like, we're going to do it. In fact, somebody asked them, why are we using the Tower of Babel? And one of the representatives that was on the European Parliament said, we are going to finish what the Babylonians could not. You'll notice the people over here in the bottom corner are all blockheads. Everybody's like very square. It's representing, a very unified stance. They're all in agreement with each other and what's going on there. Except if you see in the very corner, there's a woman holding a baby. There's also, someone has pointed out that there's kind of a shout out to homosexuality in this poster, as there are two men. This thing. Two men right here, sort of in an embrace, and the one is looking back at this woman over his shoulder, and like that's his wife, and is like, you know, making sure she's not seeing what's going on there. Europe is, of course, very open to homosexuality, but this could also be viewed as the dictator, like, embracing financial, the business people, and looking back at the woman, who of course would represent the church, kind of like, okay, I'm going to do some things that you may not be in agreement with, but this is for our good. So kind of ignoring, making sure that his wife's not seeing what's going on there. Interesting also is that she's holding a baby, and the baby is the only person in this picture that is not block. That is not square. It's got a round head, a round body. And, you can take that for whatever you want. I kind of look at that as, you know, they need to indoctrinate the youth and bring them on board, because at this point, you know, they have their own ideas and their own thoughts. And like I said, there's a lot of symbolism in here, and you can study this and you can look it up, and there's pages and pages of people who have many things to say about this, a lot more than what I've even covered. About it. But it's just interesting. This was a promotional poster for the European Parliament. If we could put up the next picture, I think it's number four. Or is that four? Five? Nope. That one. This is the European Parliament building. This is in Strasbourg, France, I believe it is. If you notice, it looks unfinished, and it even has things around it that look like scaffolding, and the top part of it up there looks very unfinished. This is their parliament building, and it does represent the Tower of Babel, the unfinished Tower of Babel, as their goal is to complete building this unified world order once again, as was started at the Tower of Babel. And if you could go to the next one, please. This is someone has taken a famous picture of the Tower of Babel and kind of overlaid it with this building. And it's just, I think that's kind of interesting to see how they can kind of blend them together. And you can, it does look like the unfinished Tower of Babel. So I just think it's interesting that Europe is embracing this symbolism of the world religion, Babylon, and tracing it all the way back to this Tower of Babel when things first failed and where people were scattered, and now they're kind of going back towards that direction. And they don't seem to be afraid to point that out to the world, that this is their goal and their mission. So those are just some things I thought pretty interesting that is happening in Europe right now as we speak. I want to go on now to Revelation 13. Starting in verse 11, it says, I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and she had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. And he exercises all authority of the first beast in his presence, and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. So we know who that first beast is, the false religion. He performs great signs so that he makes even fire come down from heaven on earth in the sight of man. So this drive towards unity is driven by commercial, financial, political, and military advantages, but it's going to take more than that to bring the people together. There's going to be a great unifying force, and that will be a common religion. Once the religious leader, who is referred to as the second beast, performs great signs so that he makes even fire come down from heaven onto the earth in the sight of men, most are going to eagerly submit to him. So we can go back now to the image at Daniel 2. And we see the 10 toes of the image represent 10 political entities, nations, or power blocks in the end time. And they're going to voluntarily submit their rule, their authority, to this power of a world dictator. And all this is going to take place shortly before Christ returns. We see here in Revelation 17, verse 12 and 13 says, these are all of one mind, which means they're all in agreement. They all are voluntarily following this leader, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. And the next verse makes it gives us a time frame of when this will all take place, because it says that they will come to make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. That's Revelation 17 and verse 4. So we see that the beast is a term used to describe a group of nations and a powerful dictator that will lead them in the end time. And as we can see, this is something that is being worked on right now and trying to be put into place. And it'll be interesting to see as time goes on what happens with Britain as they try to get out of this union, which we, of course, feel they will not be a part of it in the end time. And they're looking like whatever they can do right now to get out of this union that is taking place over there. And it will be interesting to see how Europe continues to move forward without them in there. So let's look at this great harlot now. We've read about this great harlot a few times that rides upon the beast. Revelation 17, verses 1 through 6. Once we come to see this great harlot for who she is, then we will come to see who the false prophet is. Revelation 17, starting in verse 1. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying, come, and I will show you judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of the names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. And on her forehead a name was written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. Revelation 17, verse 15, it says, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. So she's coming out of the whole world. And verse 18 says, the woman who you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. So through these few verses, we can come out with a few things that describe this woman, this great harlot. First of all, she has powerful worldwide influence. It says over peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. So there will be no barrier to who it is she has influence over. She commits fornications with the world's political leaders. So she's going to be compromising principles to be able to be a part of this in time kingdom that will be there. Many of her teachings originated in the ancient Babylonian mystery religion. As I said, there's nothing new that's being introduced here. They simply took many of the old teachings and blended them with what it is Christ was trying to bring. She is considered the mother church of many other churches. She has been responsible and will continue to be responsible for the persecution and martyrdom of many true Christians. And again, you know, as this this woman and her way begins to take a world hold, such as Sunday observance, those who refuse to observe on Sunday and want to keep the Sabbath will be persecuted. And verse 18 tells us that the woman is headquartered in that great city. And, you know, she's been in that great city since the beginning, really. Again, Europe seems to be embracing the symbolism as they begin to put themselves together here. Can you go back? I think it was first or picture two, that coin. Yeah, three. This is very interesting. This is a Greek 2 euro coin on the obverse side. Like the United States, where we have our state quarters, the nations of Europe, they have a common euro on the front of their coin, but the backside, the nations get to pick their whatever it is they want to put on there. And this is Greece's 2 euro coin. As you can see, there's a woman riding a beast. Again, I just think it's pretty interesting that they are embracing the symbolism. And can you go to the last picture? This is a statue outside of the EU Parliament building. It's just very interesting that they would have this woman riding the beast. But something even more interesting about this statue that is in front of the EU Parliament building is on the back side of the bull, it doesn't have legs holding it up. It's got these 10 glass circles. And it's just very interesting that there's 10 of them, because people have been studying this, and everything I've seen is like they can't think of any plausible reason why they would have 10 circles. There are so many other numbers that mean so much to Europe and the European Union. But it's just interesting that this ended up with these 10 glass circles that are holding it up. My own mind, I think it's interesting that they use glass, which is very fragile, because we do see the final revival of these 10 nations are going to be very strong, but at the same time very fragile in other ways that they don't necessarily blend together very well. So who is this false prophet then? Now we've seen who the beast is and this harlot that rides the beast. Who's the false prophet that is spoken of? I think most of us can figure that out, of course. Revelation 19, verse 20 says, "Then the beast was captured, and with him the false prophet who worked signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. These two were cast alive into the lake of fire, burning with brimstone." So this tells us right there that these are two distinct individuals. A lot of times people want to say beast, false prophet, antichrist, and just blend them all together as they're one person. But what we're looking at here is a great dictator type of person who will be leading the nation, and then this false prophet who will be leading the church at that time. So this false prophet is the same as the man of sin and the son of perdition, who uses powers, signs, and lying wonders in 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 3 and 4 and verse 9. He's also referred to as another horn who will persecute the saints of the Most High and shall intend to change times and law, mentioned in Daniel 7, again, changing the times and the law. It's up to whatever this false prophet decides will be the way to worship will be followed. And, of course, we know he's not having any worship directed at God the Father, but at himself and this beast power at the time. So together, this false prophet, the beast, will rule over Babylon, an evil worldwide system that entangles everything, spiritually, commercially, and culturally. So we're looking at an end-time, greedy, evil empire and a false religious system. When Christ sends down plagues and overthrows this evil empire, the merchants of the earth, we're told in Revelation 18, verse 11, the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. So we see this is definitely about commerce and, you know, the financial system of the world at that time. So this false prophet will be the leader of this great false church, which we, of course, know to be the Pope. So now let's look at the Antichrist. Who is the Antichrist? Is it the beast? Is it the false prophet? Or is it somebody else? The false prophet is most often associated with the Antichrist. That's usually the title given to the false prophet. But is the beast who will lead the armies of the earth to make war against Christ. Since both men will be the enemies of Christ, both will demand to be worshipped, both will persecute the saints, and they will be working together like a partnership. So it's probably accurate to refer to either one of them as the Antichrist, because everything they do is against what Christ taught. Right after Christ returns, John saw in the vision that these two were cast alive into the lake of burning fire, which brings up the point that when Christ returns, all Antichrist will be destroyed. The ultimate Antichrist, of course, is Satan. He has been since the beginning of time, since even before mankind. He's been against everything that God, Christ, teach and stand for. So he is the ultimate one to be referred to as the Antichrist. Satan's going to be bound. We know we're coming up on the fall holy days. We look forward to the picture of this Christ returning, of course, pictured by trumpets, Satan being bound, being pictured by the Day of Atonement, and that there's going to be loud voices in heaven saying, the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. We read about this back in Daniel, the stone that came down and struck the giant statue on the foot and broke it up. And as that statue turned to dust and was blown away by the wind, so will be all these kingdoms that we've been looking at from the time of Daniel all the way up until Christ returns. There will be nothing left of them. As we have seen, each succeeding empire that rises up is worse and worse, and especially against God and his people. So there will be nothing to salvage out of that. So when Christ returns, they will be completely removed. And then that stone, which represents Christ, will continue to grow. The beast and the false prophet are two individuals that will rise up at the end time, trying once again to unite the Holy Roman Empire. And as I said, if you are paying attention and you look now, you will see that this is taking place right now. They're going to be intertwined with each other, and they will promote both an economical system and a religious system. Again, it will be state-sponsored religion. It's not going to be, this is our preferred religion, this is what we would like for you to do. It will be, this is our religion, we will do this. And that includes the mixing together of the false religions with what Christ had brought. So as we enter into these last days, we need to be aware. We need to watch what is going on around us, and we need to watch for these individuals who will rise up. Of course, there's been many people who have risen up since Daniel's time, and we went through the nine revivals of the Roman Empire, and there's one more to come. And you know, I can think back to when I was a teenager looking at some of the leaders in Europe, and I was thinking, that's the guy, that's him right there. And it didn't turn out to be that guy. And I thought the same thing about Angela Merkel. I thought, there she is, she could be it. But we don't know who it's going to be. It'll become obvious when it starts taking place. But until then, you know, we just need to be watching ourselves. We do need to watch world events. We do need to see what's going on. God gives us all this information for a reason, and that's so we can see when things start taking place. But even more important is we need to look at ourselves and see, are we living the life we need to be living? So that when these things happen and this false prophet comes up and starts deceiving, it says, if it were possible, even the saints, are we going to be deceived? Are we going to allow this false prophet to deceive us with his miracles and these workings that he does, even though the words that he preach, we should recognize right away, is not the words of Christ? So as we enter the last days, be aware, watch world events, that we aren't caught off guard. But especially, we need to watch ourselves.
Thank you, Mr. Barker. Brethren, if we'd please take our hymnals and rise.